When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 170 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live stream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by another huge, huge talent: singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and producer, Robert Howard, aka Dr. Robert from the Blow Monkeys. We're going to take a journey through his youth, his discovery of punk, politics, and the Jam whilst living in Australia in the 1970s. He returned home in 1981 and formed the band, leading to so many fabulous albums and singles. Their debut, Limping for a Generation, that breakthrough album, Animal Magic, those hit singles, Digging Your Scene, It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, Choice, right up to their brilliant 2021 album release, Journey to You. Now, on this podcast, we're going to hear so many personal stories never told before about his friendship and collaborations with Paul Weller. Whether it's recording a Solid Bond, being part of Red Wedge, an honorary counsellor for the final live shows of the Style Council, co-producing DC Lee's Slam Slam projects, and playing on each other's early solo albums. We also chat about Rise Up Singing, the Monk's Road social collaboration that saw Paul and Robert come together for a brand new song in 2022. A real honour to have Robert on the show. Let's get into it. Robert Howard, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Dan. Nice to be here.
Delighted to have you join us, because digging into your own remarkable music, the Blow Monkeys, the brilliant solo stuff, the Monk's Road Social, which we'll talk about, all of that I'm really looking forward to talking about. And obviously the connections with Paul Weller, that's why we're here. And this is a friendship that goes back, what, nearly 40 years now, if not more.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the first time I actually met Paul would have been when we were recording our first album, Limping for Generation, which had been 83. Yeah, 40 years, you're right. Which was in Solid Bond, the old Philips studio there, Stanhope Place. Pete Wilson produced our first album. So Paul was always hanging around, and we sort of nod and then got to know each other, gently and poco a poco, as they say here in Spain. But yeah, that was the first time I'd actually met him.
Well, we'll talk about this journey and this wonderful friendship as we go through. I want to kick off social media just a few weeks back, the 2023 European tour for Paul Weller. And it was lovely to see on my socials a photo of you and Paul in Madrid there.
Yeah, well, I live down near Granada in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, up in the mountains, really, actually. And I knew that he was playing, and, it's about a 4 or 5 hour drive. And so a friend of mine who actually knew Paul as well, a journalist called Barry McElhenney, we jumped in the car and went up to see Paul. And because I hadn't seen him for a few years, I think the last time was at a Stone Foundation gig. It was so lovely, to sort of walk in and just hear, I hadn't seen the band that he has at the moment. I hadn't seen them live. So a fantastic band. Saw a few old friends like Jaco Peak and Craddock, obviously, Just lovely to see Paul backstage afterwards, and hook up, because it had been a while.
And I guess you're an audience member, right? So where did you watch the gig from?
Well, I moved about. I was at the back, as normally, at the back near the bar, though I don't drink. And then I moved up to the front. It's quite a lovely venue called the Riviera, which you can sort of move about in. So I went up the front and had a good listen as well. I was just moving about, and, there were songs I didn't recognize. There were things I did. He did some new ones. And, like always, I mean, the thing about Paul that I always loved was that he doesn't necessarily give the audience what they want. And I think that's a real strength. because, you know, I've played with him when that's happened, when you can see that they want more jam songs or they want more Style Council songs or whatever. And I really admire the fact that he sticks to his guns. Of course, he gives them a few, but mostly it's in the moment. It's the new stuff and the latest stuff. And I really admire that, because his audience, especially in the early days, they were quite conservative. He could have got away with just playing old tunes, you know, and it would have been easy. That was the same the other day when I saw him, just the same kind of mindset.
And even on this latest tour, he's played a song that was initially called Take and is now Jumble Queen, which isn't even out yet. I don't know. He obviously likes that tension of actually, I'm going to challenge you as much as, like, this is not, like you say, it's not just a greatest hits show, right?
Yeah, I understand it myself. You know, it's like you're either a museum piece or a nostalgia act, or you're somebody that still feels alive. And there's something dangerous and exciting about playing things that, you know, people haven't heard. That's a thrill, but it's also anxiety inducing. It can be, but that's what it's all about, really. I understand why some bands just go out and play that same set of songs every night that they do and they have done for years. That's okay. But someone like Paul, you know, he's far too kind of like fidgety and alive to want to just do that. So, you know, I admire that.
So you said you had the scene, Paul, for a few years, but we have had the collaboration. So this was obviously all done remotely. So before this meeting, like I say, a few weeks back, we had Rise Up singing Monk's Road Social, this wonderful single, and obviously it was part of the album as well, with you and Paul collaborating. But this must have been done with you at home, him there. How did this work?
Yeah, the COVID thing really pushed the technology forward, like the remote stuff. Although I haven't seen each other, we're in touch quite a lot. Paul loves a WhatsApp at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know? and I'm a bit like that myself. So, you know, how about this? Do you think you like this? You know, maybe we could try something with this. And oh, yeah. And then he's off and running. And I don't know if it's a secret, but I think he's done another version of Rise Up Singing that might be on the new album as well. And then there were songs of his like Serafina. There was a kind of bonus track somewhere along the line. And we did a version, which I really like, with Matt Dayton's daughter, Romy. It was all, you know, a lot of the people in the Monk's Road thing were people that I had met through working with Paul. So obviously Mick Talbert, Steve White, you know, and there was that kind of extended family. And then we had to get Paul in eventually because, you know, that's to complete the set. And,
it did feel inevitable that at some point he was going to have to come in, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he seems to be more up for that than ever, collaborations and sort of widening the net and just letting the music lead you to wherever it might take you, which is really what it's all about, because in the end, that's all we have sometimes.
We'll return to Monk's Road Social a bit later on. I want to go right back to the beginning, this love of music, where it comes from. You mentioned Paul Weller meeting 83. Were you aware of the Jam?
I actually grew up in a place called King's Lynn in Norfolk, although I was born in Scotland. Both my parents are big time into music. My mum was a kind of part-time singer, jazz singer occasionally. My dad was a really good singer in the car. Of Perry Como and Matt Monro. And then my two elder sisters, 10 years and older than me, sort of experienced the whole of the 60s. So although I was only little, I discovered the kind of the dance set up in their bedroom with all the Beatles singles, lots of Bacharach and David. The whole 60s experience was in my mind. And then obviously for my own generation, it was obviously Mark Bolan was a massive thing, Bowie. So fast forward to about 1977, my father dies and we're going to go and live in Australia, me and my mum. And just as we're about to leave King's Lynn, by this time punk is broken and I'm well aware of it and everything. I see an advert and there were never any gigs in Norfolk, but there was this place called West Swanton Pavilion. And there was a poster up in King's Lynn and it said T-Rex and the Damned. And it was T-Rex's last ever tour and the Damned toured with them. I moved to Australia 2 weeks before that. I couldn't believe it. So I'd already got, you know, punk had already been a big thing for me. I mean, the King's Lynn was a Northern Soul town where I grew up. You know, so soul music, and there's a place called the Soul Bowl, which was the import record shop. And all my friends used to go and I was just too young to go into those things, but I was aware of it and it was a big part of my life. But then punk comes along and the first single that anybody could get, I think, was New Rose by the Damned. That was the one. So I was in then. And so I went to Australia and I mean, it was a massive thing. Flying into Sydney was like going from King's Lynn in 1977 was like going from black and white to colour. My whole life changed. I looked at it and I thought, and so many things were happening to me on an emotional level and all sorts. by this point, I was totally hooked with music. So I was staying in a little flat with my sister. She was learning to play guitar. She had a little Spanish guitar lying about with a copy of The Eagles Made Easy, and she went off to work. And by the time they came back, I'd learned that whole thing. And this is the first time I'd ever picked up a guitar.
Wow, what?
So it just came to me real simple. And of course, you know, because I love Mark Bolan songs, they were really simple to play as well. So I was straight off on sort of Hot Love and Deborah, because they only need two chords, you know. And so I was deeply, and then I started going to these import record shops in Sydney. There was one called Anthem Records, and I saw In the City. So I'd heard of the Jam because I was an avid reader of Melody Maker and NME, which in those days, they were the Bible. I mean, they were selling 300,000 records copies a week. And some of the writers in there were much better than the music they were writing about, because they would turn you on to, like, you know, people like Charles Salmari, Nick Kent. They would turn you on to kind of existential poets and writers and philosophers. They would talk about politics, and they would bring this all into an article on, I don't know, the Comsat Angels or something. You know what I mean? It was really, like, educational. So it was music that politicized me as well. But anyway, so I bought all those albums. I bought all the Buzzcocks, the Jam, everything. And the Jam in particular affected me, because I'd already gotten into Down by the Jetty by Dr. Feelgood, and there was something in there that really reminded me of that kind of energy, that guitar playing. And there was also something that really struck me. I think it was Away from the Numbers was the tune, which I thought had a kind of romanticism that I wasn't hearing anywhere else in any punk tunes, particularly because everybody was trying to be hard and sort of, it was year zero and there was a Stalinist approach to anything that had gone before. Paul was obviously different. There was something in that tune that alerted me to something. I mean, obviously I loved In the City and all the kind of, like, you know, the fast stuff, but there was something in that tune which rang a bell. So I just, from that moment on, really, amongst a lot of other things, I just bought everything that came out, every single, every album. So from right from the end, really, 77, I was in.
There's a difference between you can strum away on a guitar and learning the art of songwriting and being able to sing, having a voice. I mean, thank goodness for that, right? When you look at your albums, and I know this has evolved over time, but there are so many instruments that you play. It's not just the guitar, there are keys, drums, there's bass, there's percussion on so many of your songs as well. So are you one of those people that just wants to learn how to, or are you just happy to have a go? How does it work?
I'm just not very good at paying other musicians.
Just tight.
Tight, that's it. Scottish, you see. Born in Scotland. That's, let's not indulge in national stereotypes. It's not true. I have drummed on a couple of things, but I wouldn't call myself a drummer. People who know me would laugh at me.
But there's a drum kit right behind you.
I know. I like to have a bash. I don't know. I'm a ham-fisted piano player, but I can get away with it. I love playing bass. I loved playing bass with Paul, because I just like playing bass. Just as you go along, you know, it's like in the studio, as I went through my journey and sort of making records, I got more and more into, like, learning about everything that's going on, because I became frustrated with handing over at a certain point to somebody else and wondering why the sound got fucked up, what happened. So I got to be a little bit technical as well. Even with Paul in Star Council Records, I remember I was the one that was using the sampler and the Akai very early on. In fact, I think I'm credited as the Akai kid on something. You know, because I just wanted to learn how these things work. I'm a bit of a nerd. So, or maybe not so secretly. So that's what it is. Partly a control freakery and partly just interested in it.
It's also that ownership thing, isn't it? Because I think your name's on there, certainly, you know, the solo stuff, your name is definitely on them. But, you know, the Blow Monkeys, that's your product. You want to own it. And so when you create this music and it comes out sounding different to how you heard it or your expectation, it must be hugely frustrating, right?
Yeah, it can be, you know, especially early on, I couldn't figure out what was going on. Why were the demos better that we made than sometimes the records? And of course, it was the 80s production values that we were kind of involved in, which kind of took over, you know. For a while, that really bugged me, but I've sort of come to terms with it now. In fact, you know, it's all part of the journey. So, it's just a learning curve, really.
I found a quote in research from Paul Weller, and the fact that he'd once said to you, when we talk about playing, he once said to you, you've got no reputation as a guitar player, but you're fucking brilliant.
He did say that to me once. I don't know about the fucking brilliant bit. I might have made that up. He, it's true, because we used to play, because we lived not far from each other in West London at a certain point in the mid 80s, and our kids grew up together and we'd go on holiday together. So we were pretty close and the guitars would come out and there were kind of relaxed moments. And I think, he sussed then that, you know, I remember one time I was playing a song called Fly from All Mod Cons. It's got quite a tricky guitar part. I think just to impress him, really. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's good. So it was just something that happened, you know, and then he asked me to go and play on, I mean, the first thing I actually played guitar on, I think, was Into Tomorrow. Just a rhythm guitar, really. It didn't need me, but I mean, I was honored to sort of play on it. And then from then on, you know, started playing on a few more. I mean, obviously, I think it's when I was producing DC Lee's album, Slam Slam, I was playing quite a bit of guitar and things like that. And he flopped it a little bit through my own fault, really. I mean, it was like in the '80s, I would just sort of like ponce about, you know, on telly. That's what I thought you did, you know. and so people had the idea. So when I went to do solo things very early on in the '90s, just acoustic guitar, I think people were kind of like, oh, you can actually play. Oh, it's not bad, you know, sort of condescending. But because I'd sort of probably been my own worst enemy sometimes in the '80s in that way. You know, I was far too good looking as well. So just, it went against me.
Yeah. Well, also I think there's a period with Paul. If you discovered Paul like midway through the Style Council, you wouldn't have realized he was a guitar player. Like, he seemed to shy away from that a little bit. And maybe that was mirroring what he saw you doing and thinking, I'll give this a go as well.
I don't know if I mirrored anything, but I think I do remember him falling out of love with playing the guitar at a certain point. Yeah, that was definitely true. And that was part of the rediscovery that he had, you know, in the early 90s, was just playing guitar again. I think that was an end for him, you know, to fall in love with playing guitar again. Because he was such, I mean, I talked about those early jam records, you know, when I was learning to play guitar, I had this stereo at home in my little flat with my mum, where I could plug in this cheap guitar I had halfway and I could sort of play along in the headphones to the record that was on. I'd found some sort of weird kind of space, liminal space between stereo and mono that I didn't know existed. So I could play along. And of course, I was playing along to like Buzzcocks and Clash and Jam. And Jam was like, oh, hang on, there's some chords in here. I mean, for those that want to know, the first time I'd ever learned to play like a major seventh chord was playing along to Down in the Tube Station at Midnight. Now, nobody in punk used major seven chords. Of course, you know, later when I realized I understand the lineage with Ray Davis and Pitt and Townsend and the kind of the writing. But at the time, I was really unaware of that. And so that's the first time I think, oh, and that leads you into a whole other world. Because Paul knows his shit when it comes to chords and, it, you know, fire and skill. It wasn't pretending to be, I can't play.
I guess also that idea of, like you say, your love of Motown. I know you're a huge fan of like Bacharach and David, which is, you know, linking in there with the lyrics. And so you get all that from the Jam as well, don't you? You get that heritage of where it's come from, because Paul didn't shy away from that. But also this amazing ability to write incredible stories through his songs must have just been inspiring as well.
Yeah, I mean, they were like, I suppose for me in particular, All Mod Cons and Setting Suns were the ones that, because I was at a particular age, I was in a particular place emotionally. I was learning. I was 12,000 miles away from what I considered to be home. That things like, and I've told him this, you know, The Place I Love, you know, or Burning Sky, or Little Boy Soldiers, Saturday's Kids. They were just little play for today's, weren't they? They were just perfect. And they hit me at a time when I was emotionally open. So they were particularly powerful for me, those particular albums.
When was it that you found the confidence to take this out of your bedroom, out of home, plugging in halfway into that stereo, like you say there, and out on the streets? Because you started busking initially, was that right?
Yeah, well, that's what I could say. I mean, it was almost the next day.
Really?
there was a German guy called Helmer, a friend of my mum's and my sister's, who said he was busking at Circular Quay in Sydney. And I said, I'll come along. And he was doing things like Wild World, Cat Stevens, and some Dylan things. And I just played along with him when we stood there. And then at the end of it, I said, I sort of went into some weird kind of Tyrannosaurus Rex things, which was, you know, I'm quite want to do after having a beer. And then people stopped and sort of put money in the, whatever it was, the hat that we had down there. And I think from that moment on, I was hooked. I probably was 16 then. And then I started just improvising, and pretty soon Helmut stopped coming and it was just me, and I could never remember the words to songs at that time, so I started making my own up, and it was really just based on improvisation in front of people busking that became the drug, you know, that became, oh, somebody's put like a dollar in the hat there, and you know, there's something there. So that's when the writing started. I mean, it was awful. Absolutely. I recorded an album once in Australia, and thank God it never came out, as I was travelling through on my way out up in Darwin. It was awful, but that's where that would have been the sort of beginning of it. Yeah,
there comes a confidence in that, though. That I mean, this is a young man who's, like you say, moved 12,000 miles away from the place he called home. You're going through this trauma of losing your father, right? Where did that confidence come from to perform in public when you've literally picked up the guitar the previous day?
I don't know. I think it was partly, I'll be honest with you, it was partly, well, what the hell am I going to do with my life? And when I got to Australia, I took a year out of school because I'd had such a traumatic time. I hated school in England. You know, I ended up at some grammar school passing. I failed 11 plus, so I went to some god-awful boarding school for a year. And then I passed something called the 13 and went to a grammar school. And it was full of sadistic teachers who would cane you and would sort of make you stay behind and write out lines. It was just... And a lot of these guys had served in the Second World War. They were kind of remnants of that kind of Victorian almost kind of age. And so I just was like, I'm not going back to school. So when I went to Australia, I tried to get jobs, but I got a job as a trainee pharmacist on the day that Elvis died. I remember that. And after 2 weeks, I was very good at getting the jobs. And then there would be this regular kind of payoff where they'd say, listen, mate, you're not cut out for this. And that would be after 2 weeks. So this kept happening. So I realized that, no, you're quite right. I'm not cut out for this. I can't seem to settle into any job. So I went back to school in Australia, a surf school in a place called Manly in North Sydney. And that was a completely different experience. Like the kids would come in dripping. They'd been surfing at 5 a.m, you know, and there was no uniform and they all smoked dope and they called the teachers by their first names. And it was like, fucking hell, this is freedom after what I'd been in. So I actually did quite well. I took the equivalent of the A-levels and I got a scholarship and got into Sydney University. So I went to Sydney University and after 2 weeks, my grant arrived. You know, it was the only time in my life I'd ever had any money. So I went straight out and bought a Rickenbacker and an amp and left university. Because I spent all my money on a blue Rickenbacker. Thank you, Paul. That's your fault. And that was it, really. So, yeah, what was the question?
Yeah, the busking, you know, was paying back the grant.
Yeah, busking all the time. So you know, what's the motivation to get out and do it? Fear and this and some sort of something inside that just needed to express. I love the act of singing. I realised that I did enjoy singing, even though I couldn't really sing. There was something cathartic about just doing that. Like I said, I was a massive Mark Bolan fan, and Mark Bolan had died around the same time. Somebody had bought me all the Tyrannosaurus Rex albums, and I dove deep into those four albums. And of course, as I'm learning to play guitar acoustic, all those kind of weird songs, which were very simple, became a template for me as well. So, you know, and I sang them and played them. So there was, I don't know, it was just a mixture of all that, Dan. I don't really know where that came from.
Paul's talks about in recent years feeling now that he's really in control of his voice. He really loves the way he sings, but when he listens back to older stuff, he's not keen, whether it's the Jam or the Style Council. And I get that. You can hear that. Would you feel the same? It's that evolution and actually where you are now.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I can't listen. I mean, well, there was a time that I couldn't listen to, say, like the first album, Limpid for Generation, or even It's So Mannered, you know. But then... there's something I like about that too now. I can accept it's all part of the journey. And yeah, Paul, I mean, Paul's singing now is incredible. He's got this new range, like the lower end, you know, the kind of things he was doing, even watching him the other week live, you know. And I'm the same in the sense that my voice has changed and you go with it because that's all part of the thing. But I laugh when I hear myself. I can hear the kind of influences and I can hear the straining, but there's something about that as well, you know, which is, you know, it's all part of the journey.
So you come home, the Blow Monkeys are formed in 1981, would that be right?
Yeah.
Was there a moment where you go, you know, now this is taking off, now we're getting somewhere, I can see this is where I want it to be?
Getting signed was a shock. You know, I mean, you know, I come back, I did the thing that everyone does. I answered an ad in the back of the Melody Maker. It said, angular guitarist wanted. Ferry Bowie Bolan. I thought, okay, angular guitar. Is that somebody who's into fishing or is that somebody that...
has good cheekbones.
Yeah. Well, okay. I was in... At that time in my life, I had both those attributes. So I went along with a fishing rod. No, I didn't. I went along with my old blue Rickenbacker and I got the job and I met Neville there. And within like a couple of kind of rehearsals, we... You know, I'd come in with a bunch of songs and a whole idea about what, you know, Neville, the sax player, I'd met. So it was pretty obvious straight away that things were going to change, and then we found Mick, and things happened real quick. And I'd seen this band in Australia called The Laughing Clowns. I just rewind quickly. In Australia, I went there thinking, right, I'm at the ends of the earth. What the hell? I should be in London, all these punk bands. And then the first band I see in Australia were a band called The Saints, who were mind-blowing. Actually, they supported The Jam. I've talked to Paul about this. They were unbelievable. They were pre-punk, like the Ramones were pre-punk in America. It was so powerful. And a band called The Boys Next Door, which was Nick Cave's first band. So I suddenly see, like, Ed Cooper and Nick Cave were the two figureheads of Australian music for me at that time. Pretty quickly, my mind changed. And I'd seen The Laughing Clowns. And The Laughing Clowns had this bebop drummer, and they had this out-of-tune brass section, and they had Ed Cooper playing, like, this punky guitar. And I thought, that's the blueprint. That's what I want. So that's what I had in mind when I went along and I met Neville. And I sort of did the Trotsky thing. I got in the band and we got rid of most of the band, and that was it. There was just me and Neville. and then I didn't know anybody. We didn't have any gigs. We didn't have anything. So it was 2 years of being on the dole, just trying to get a couple of gigs going. When you could get on the dole before, you can't do that now because they'll send a drone around and tell you that you need to go. And, you know, so it was a safety net that provided a lot of bands wouldn't have been able to survive without that.
You got signed on the strength of what, demos?
Well, yeah. And then we got a residency at a place called the Moonlight Club. And I noticed that record companies started turning up. So that was it. That was the beginning of, but we were, you know, we weren't really ready. But anyway, we got signed 83 on a bunch of songs that I think only Man From Russia survived the cut to the first album. But yeah, so they just put us away. The guy that signed us left 2 weeks afterwards to go into rehab. And so we were left there. They didn't know what to do with us, but they thought there was something. So they put us in this studio called Gnomis to rehearse, which is actually where I met Paul first, because the Jam had an office in Gnomis. John would always be in there. I just saw the Jam once, weirdly. And that was, they did some kind of C&D festival on the back of a truck at Temple. Was it Temple Station? And I went around the corner and the Jam were on, and I swear to God, I didn't imagine this. They were playing a song called Desdemona, which was a band called John's Children, which was a Mark Bolan song. That's the one and only time they'd ever did it. And that was it. I think I saw that one song and they finished. I only ever saw the one song. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, we got signed 83 after, you know, a few dark nights of the soul, just carrying on. I was very, you know, particular. I used to say, right, we're going to all leave our job. Well, I didn't have a job. Everybody leave your jobs. We're going to rehearse. We're going to be a proper band. We're going to do it. And I used to send out kind of weekly letters saying, this is what we're into and this is what we're not into. In those days, it was important to be as against things as it was for things, you know. I was just desperately trying to get better, really. Writing, just trying to find something, my voice. And luckily, they believed in me.
So you mentioned Pete Wilson connected obviously with Paul, and the Solid, what becomes the Solid Bond Studio, is involved in those first couple of albums as well. Also actually on Animal Magic, which I know you've revisited recently, was it last year, with reissue and repackage, and we had like extras and all that kind of stuff. But on that we had strings from John Mealing. He was obviously involved in part of the Style Council set up at one point too.
I loved Funeral Pyre, the tune. I loved the noise, the energy. And I thought, who produced it? Oh, Pete Wilson. All right. So when I went to RCA, they said, who do you want to produce? I said, Pete Wilson. Of course, Funeral Pyre really has nothing to do with Pete Wilson. It's to do with Paul. I mean, it's Paul's guitar sound, and then the drums are great. And then that Pete's great, right? I love Pete. But that particular tune was, and so anyway, a lot of the people that Pete used for the Style Council, he used for us, because, you know, same string section would come in. If we needed a soprano player, we had Dick Morrissey, I think. Mm-hmm. And then there was John Mealing. Yeah, a lot of that kind of similar people were getting involved.
Guy Barker, who's been
Guy
on
Barker,
the podcast.
Guy Barker, the great Guy Barker, you know. And because we were at Solid Bond, you know, there was a big crossover, you know. Years later, when I moved to Spain, I met a guy here called Dick Leahy, who was a publisher, and he published Tank Called Malice, Morrison Leahy. But he, before he'd done that, he worked as a tea boy for Fontana in that same building, because that building used to be the Phillips building before it was Solid Bond. That building had so much history, you know. Scott Walker did his, and the Walker Brothers, and, you know, all those tunes, Dusty Springfield, you know, Kinks, an amazing studio, the history of it. I didn't know that at the time that was in there, but it's funny how it goes, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned earlier this love of politics and...
I wouldn't go that far, Dan.
Well, this interest.
Interesting, yeah.
Interest in politics. This leads us in nicely to talking about Red Wedge. And I'm guessing this is where your friendship with Paul like properly develops around this time as well?
Yeah, I'd say too. We were on nodding terms. And I remember like talking to him a couple of times when we were recording Limping. But Red Wedge, I loved the idea. I wanted to do it, but I didn't want to just jump on. And luckily, we'd had a hit. We'd had a hit with Digging. So Digging Your Scene was suddenly like exploding. And so I felt that, okay, we can do it now because, you know.
Yeah, this is not going to kill us off by doing Red Wedge.
We've been on top. Well, not only that, but it's just that I didn't want to jump on some bandwagon to make it look like we were looking for kind of help. It came at the right time. We did the second Red Wedge tour. It was a real lovely atmosphere, actually. It was the first time where I'd been a part of anything where you were part of something, a collective, that wasn't just about furthering your own career, which everybody was competitive in music and everybody was like, you know, and I was young and ambitious and competitive too. The Star Council kind of hosted the whole thing. You know, Kenny Wheeler was running it, John, although I don't know whether they were very, I don't know if their politics were the same, I don't know. Paul definitely was. And so we'd use their backline and then we'd all get together and do something at the end of the night, move on up usually with everyone. And then Paul said, well, let's do that one of yours with, you know, Curtis. So I tied him the chords and all that. I was really nervous, but it was just a lovely thing. And then I got to know Mick Talbot really well. And Mick's, you know, I made friends on that tour, Rhoda Dakar, people like that, D, that I've kept for 40 years. It's special.
I can't remember. This came up on my socials the other day. So Neil Sheesby, Stone Foundation, has the cover of NME, May 1987, framed on his wall. I don't know if you've ever seen this on anything on social media. And it was the Blow Monkeys and Curtis Mayfield. And it said, banned by the Beeb, loved by the left, was the headline on the front cover. Do you remember this?
Yeah, well, yeah, of course I remember it. Yeah, Curtis was playing. I think I went to see Curtis at Dingwalls. And I went backstage and found out where he was staying. This is the honest truth. I went up to his hotel in Tottenham Court Road. This would have been 1987, or might have been late 86. And I had this tune on cassette, Celebrate. You know, and by this point, you know, we've toured America, we've had a hit, blah, blah, blah. I'm full of it. And I'm going in and he's sitting on his bed in this little hotel room and he's writing a song. I could see he's written a song. It's called Homeless, which came out later. He's sitting on the bed like some kind of guru. And he is a guru. And I'm sitting there, thank you, Mr. Mayfield. Have a listen. So he puts headphones on. And while he's listening, and there's a knock at the door. I open the door. It's Paul. Oh, all right, mate. Yeah. Paul had come to see Curtis because Paul was getting Curtis to do some mixes on, what was it now?
The Cost of Loving album.
Yeah, that album. Yeah. That album. That time. So it was me and Paul and Curtis sitting on the bed in Curtis's hotel room.
That's like you've both turned up to see the same girl or something at the same time.
I know. It's like, I know it was slightly embarrassing, but it was funny as well. Anyway, I got to work with Curtis and I'm in the studio and I'm singing right in front of him. He's like there, 2 feet away. And I'm doing my Curtis Mayfield impression. Everybody says, you know, and I'm thinking, fucking hell. This is unreal, you know. Part of me thinking that, and the other part is like, just keep it together and do it. So we were doing the thing live. Record comes out and it gets banned because the week of release, there was an election called. Thatcher called an election. She did this deliberately. I know this. And so the Radio 1 wouldn't playlist it. So the record gets the number 41, I think, which means you just can't get on Top of the Pops. I mean, we did plenty of other things. He came and played at the Hammersmith Odeon with us. And oh, that was fantastic, playing Superfly on stage with him. And we went to Montreux. One of the loveliest people, like all the true, true, true greats, he was very kind of modest, you know? Like he was channeling something very special and he didn't need to impress anyone. Picked up his guitar once, tried to play it. And for any of those muses out there, he tuned the whole thing to open F sharp, which is all the black notes on the piano. That's how he got his sound. That sound that you hear on the impressions is kind of flickering, kind of hammering, beautiful, kind of crystalline sound. That's how you do it, F sharp. There you go, kids, open F sharp.
So Red Wedge, Billy Bragg's been on the podcast, you know, Anna Joy David, Rhoda, yeah. You mentioned, yeah. Junior's been on the podcast. If you look back on Red Wedge, what are your thoughts on what it achieved? And you've probably talked to Paul about this, I'm sure, but what's in your head?
Well, I thought it was about haircuts. I joined it because I had a wedge and I thought that was Billy's thing. I think I was, you know, what did I think it achieved? Listen, like I said to you before, I think it was music that politicized me. It was music that first made me think about where do I stand in this? What do I believe in? What do I want to be part of? How do I see society? What's important? And okay, so Paul and Strummer, like I said, some of those journalists that were writing about, especially during the time when Neil Spencer was kind of editor at The Enemy, really led me into places that opened my mind. That's all it was, really. And you've got to remember that at the time it was years and years and this endless, grueling era of Thatcherism, which had decimated working class communities, decimated the manufacturing base of the UK. We're still paying the price for that. The kind of mantra of the market will decide, you know, the kind of way things have gone and still are going. That's where the seeds of that were during that Reagan Thatcher era. And I felt on a kind of spiritual level that it was counter to kind of human nature, that it was about survival of the fittest, no such thing as society, blah, blah, blah. This, to me, felt like contrary to what I had found to be my experiences in life, that altruism pays off, that we are all connected and interconnected, and that these values are really important. And so that's what I took from it. I went along to the meetings in the Houses of Parliament and sat inside the shadow cabinet with Neil Kinnock, you know, David Blunkett and all these. And there was this guy circling behind us, this kind of Machiavellian geezer who turns out to be Peter Mandelson, who I'm sure didn't approve, you know. And we went up to Liverpool and you met old Degsy, you know, Derek Hatton, who was a bigger rock star than anyone I'd ever met, you know. So there were things that I didn't like about it. And in the end, what did it achieve? I don't know. What it would achieve would be that anybody like me when I was younger, who might have looked at it and thought, this has got me interested in participation. And great friends I made.
And like you say, those friendships last to this day.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And towards the end of the Style Council, you start working with Paul and collaborating with Paul on some of the Style Council stuff. And we should talk about the House period, because that seems like a big passion point for both of you at that time. You were working on Slam Slam, DC Lee's project, working with Paul on that as well. So you suddenly come together to collaborate.
Yeah. I mean, the House thing, I shared a flat with a guy called Hector, who was a DJ at the WAG Club, but had previously been a DJ in Northern Soul Clubs up in Derby. And when we toured America, he gave me this list of records to go and get at this specific record shop in Chicago, 86. So I go and get them all, and I start to listen, you know, early Marshall Jefferson, things like that. Oh, man, you know, there's something really good about this. These are like homemade records that are trying to sound like Philly kind of soul records, but they've got this kind of, but obviously they're made at home on the late tracks. And then there's a guy, and then Marco Nelson, who become part of our friendship circle, had started to really go on about house music as well. And I think we all kind of coalesced at the same time when we were inspired by this. But because I'm the nerd, I learned how to do it. So I've got a million cables of MIDI cables and a sampler and a keyboard. And I'm just playing at home and I make up weight. And I think, you know, well, okay, so this isn't a Blow Monkeys thing. I'll do it solo single. And I said to the record company, just give me 2 days. I'm going to do a solo single. At this point, they said, yeah, all right then. And I first recorded it actually with Sam Brand, the singer Sam Brand. And her management said, we don't think it's right for us.
Oh, my goodness me. So is there a version of that kicking around somewhere still?
Probably. Sam Brand didn't do Wait, but she did Stop. And then Paolo Hewitt, dear old Paolo, who was also at that point part of the same friendship circle, said, listen, Kim Mazzell's in town. Why don't you get her on? That was just it. That was really just magic. So it happened very quickly. I had this tune. And of course, the record company heard it, and they put out 12 inches, and it started to blow up. So it became a single, and it went out on a Blow Monkeys album because they wanted to sell the Blow Monkeys album. So I was, you know, I got a little bit of a head start in there. But Paul's doing Promised Land and things like that with Brendan. And I sort of, I'm just sort of hanging around. I'm helping with the kind of technical shit, I think, at this point, archives. And actually, you know what? Not many people know this, but Paul plays bass on Wait, because he came in while I was doing it. Because at this point, I think there was tension. It was coming towards the end of the Style Council. And I don't think he was very happy. You know, in fact, I know he wasn't very happy. And there was, and he did come down the studio. We used to work a lot down at Goldwater Road, the townhouse. And he came in there. And he was sitting there and we were playing and I was doing Wait. And he said, there's no bass on it. I said, no, I haven't done it yet. So the Juno was there and he just played this bass line, which actually I think was a, it was very similar actually to something by Ten City, but it perfectly worked. It was perfect. And so I said, oh, cheers, man. That's brilliant. You know, and so that's how that kind of, that's how it kind of went. You know, you just started hanging around. So I started hanging around a bit more when he was doing things and I'd pick up this instrument or that instrument or make small suggestions. I think he tweaked that and said, do, you know, have a go at doing these albums, Slam Slam. I think if he's honest at that point, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't, although I love some of that art. Sure as Sure is a great tune and there was some beautiful things on it. He wasn't really happy personally or musically at that point, you know, I would say.
You become part of the Style Council, the honorary, an honorary Style Councillor for those last few dates. So Japan, and we'll talk more about Japan and how important that has been for you and your solo career in a sec. We also play the final day of the Style Council, the Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah. He asked me to play those and the Albert Hall was fun. I loved it. I mean, it's gone down in as a little bit of a kind of like, they were tearing up programs. They were booing a bit. I mean, this is what I mean about not giving your audience what they want. I totally respect that. It was such fun. Amazing band. I mean, Steve White wasn't playing. I remember that Steve wasn't playing, but there was like Guy Barker, Jacko was in it. Omar came and did something in the middle of it, some sort of like, you know, beatbox thing that I remember flummoxed John Weller. What's going on there? And then there was like Marco was dancing with D. And then I did a couple of tunes. We didn't come to see you, mate. So I just, but I loved it. I loved it. And Paul was, you know, Paul only sang on about half the songs, as I recall, but it was brilliant. And, but, you know, I think you could see that there were one or two in the audience that didn't get what they expected, you know.
I think it wasn't helped by the fact that Style Council just released a Greatest Hits album, right? And they were possibly thinking they were going to get that. But like you say, Paul's always done what he feels is right for him and his career and his music as much as, you know, he appreciates us as fans and loves us as fans, I'm sure.
Yeah, you got to remember that I think the Jam audience could be quite scary, quite kind of male, kind of possibly quite conservative, some of them. And I think he wanted to escape that. So the biggest move was from there to the Style Council. That was the one that pissed a lot of people off. And that was so brave. And he's just carried on doing that, carried on following that voice inside that says, this is where I should be. I think that's all part of this kind of modernist philosophy that encompasses almost everything in his world. This kind of going forward, new, keep going forward, keep going forward. Don't get caught in nostalgia. Don't even look backwards, although, you know, occasionally he will, but now I think. But, you know, it's a continuous, it's always being in the moment, always going with what's happening here and now, new. I respect that. You know, working with Paul, there were a few things that I really picked up. I think when he started to hang about with us at the end of the 80s, he was a little bit inspired by the energy that we were doing. He'd forgotten about that because it got a bit stale for him. But then when he starts again and I'm hanging about with him, I'm noticing these things, this incredible attention to detail, this work ethic about not letting anything, if there's half a song there, we're going to finish that. We're going to take that all the way. We're going to finish it. Finish things, attention to detail, you know, making it sound great on that speaker, but also on that speaker. And all these little things, you know, that they're kind of all inspiring.
The connections continue with Paul in his solo career. So that first solo album, Wildwood, Stanley Road, you're hanging out a lot. I think you just mentioned the fact that you'd moved closely together. You've just both had kids around the same time. Would that be right?
Yeah, I mean, I was involved on the first solo album. Well, the first single, actually, he said he's doing this Into Tomorrow. Into Tomorrow was like, oh, okay, that's the beginning. That's the beginning of something new. I could see. First of all, he's playing the guitar again. I mean, I love that song. It's just something, it's so stripped back. It was so out of what else was going on. It wasn't like anything else. There was this kind of stripped back honesty to it. And then I moved out of London and I moved up to Oxfordshire. And it just so happens that I was like very close to the manor, which is where Paul started to record a lot. So again, I'm in the manor quite a lot just because my mate is around the corner. You just picking up, you know, I picked up a bass. I played on Cosmos. Somebody clocked it, said, oh, you know, play a bit more bass, play a bit more this and that. It was just whatever was hanging about. You pick it up and play it, you know. But you could see almost on a daily basis that something Paul was getting inspired again, almost like a child, you know, lost in music again. I mean, there were things going on in his personal life that were very difficult. I could see that. But the music was leading him to, he was allowing the music to flow and overtake him again. And that was beginning to be reflected. And he did it the old fashioned way by playing live again. John saying, right, get out there and play live again. That's all you can do.
The manor famously was this residential studio. The fact that you're living down there, were you staying over or are you popping back home again after these sessions?
Well, I mean, at this point in my life, I'm still drinking. So there were times when I was staying over for quite a few days sometimes. Very nice it was as well. I've got to say, it's a lovely place, you know. Full-size snooker table. Now, I'm quite a keen snooker player. So after a few drinks, although I would sometimes lose quite a bit of money to John and Kenny on the tour bus playing cards, I would always make it up later playing snooker.
Brilliant. So yeah, around this time you start playing live with the band as well. But this ties in as well with your first solo album, Realms of Gold, which is a thing of beauty, my friend. Honestly, it's such a brilliant album. And again, that came from the connection. I talked about the Japanese connection. Paul's first solo album was financed by Pony Canyon. Am I right in thinking that same connection enabled you to do your first solo album? Would that be right?
Yeah, because we've both been to Japan a lot. It was successful there. There was a kind of, you know, and at this point, they offered me the best deal I could get, which gave me enough to go and record the album. So I went to this out of the studio in Leamington Spa, and Paul very kindly came down for about 2 days, stayed in a hotel and just played on it on loads of stuff. Just put the track up and let him play. He picked up a bass, so he played piano, he did some backing vocals. So he ends up all over Realms of Gold. And I had played quite a bit on, well, his first album and Wildwood and Stanley Road. He was always sacking his bass players. and I think I was in Japan, done some gigs with the Blow Monkeys maybe or something, or maybe solo gigs. And then I was supporting him solo, acoustic. And then it wasn't Yolanda, it was someone else he was playing and they weren't happy. And I think it was Steve White that actually suggested to Paul, to get Robin, you know. So he sends me a fax when we get back to England with all the chords and all the bits and pieces. And he just says at the end, I know you were, you'll be fine. You got a good feel. And I thought, oh, that'll do. Because I was like, fucking hell, how am I going to learn all these songs? But it was fine. And I've never played bass with people live before. And I loved it because, first of all, you're playing with one of the great drummers of all time. And when Steve went and did a drum fill, I just took a little break and came back in afterwards because they were so good. And it was just nice to stand at the back and play with someone else. And of course, things were beginning to happen. I remember playing Changing Man and no one had ever heard it before. We played it live, you know, and instantly you could see, wow, this is, you know what I mean? It was just great fun. Great fun. And for me, on a personal level, that Weller family thing. I mean, I was good friends with a whole lot of them. You know, they make you feel very, very at home. John in particular, I really got on well with. John, like my father was an ex-boxer in the RAF. John was a very successful ex-boxer. So there were similarities. There were things that I could relate to, the things that we would talk about. And it just instinctively got on really well. So that whole experience was really immersive and special. And for not just for me, but for my wife, Michelle, who was good friends with everyone as well.
I mean, like you say, Paul's all over the album. There's a wonderful track where the two of you, what song is Have No Roots? And it's just you and Paul and your vocals, you're on guitar, percussion. I think Paul's on a 12 string. I think he plays a bit of bass, but it's a song created by the two of you from what I can work out, right?
Yeah. He really brought something to that. He liked that one. It was, it just came in and started suggesting BB ideas and played. He's a really good bass player, you know, really good. I mean, I think that's what Paul started out on. And he had one of those Hofner kind of Paul McCartney type basses and just nailed it first take. I mean, like, phew. And, there were other things we did when we were just jamming as well. I remember we played, Neil Young's Out on the Weekend. We did a whole take of that somewhere. There were other things. So I played the Moon Fiddler acoustic room. I was right at the beginning of my solo career, he came up and he did some Red Balloon, Tim Hardin, and we did Life's a Gas, Mark Bolan. I think it's on film somewhere. I think Johnny Chandler's going to get it for me.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, there was a lot of kind of, I remember saying to him, I really love these Scott Walker albums, and there's this guy, Tim Hardin, that he covers. And he said, oh, yeah, he told me about it. And then he bought me this Tim Hardin box set that came out. He was very generous that way. He bought me that kind of bought records, and we'd swap things like that, you know. It was turning each other on to stuff that we hadn't heard, I guess. You know, I remember making up a tape and putting Nick Drake Riverman on there, which I think then became a big tune for him and the whole Nick Drake experience and stuff. And that kind of, there were times when we would just sit and just play two acoustics without saying much. I know that sounds kind of romantic and a bit of this and that, but really it's the musical connection that is the real bond, the solid bond. I think he'd say that as well.
I would imagine also at the time for Paul and yourself, the drinking would have been a connection as well. And there's a track on the album called Ode to Bacchus, Bacchus being the Roman god of wine and festivity, I think it is, where that was a kind of drinking song, right? From the vine to the vein, from the bloodstream to the brain, only you can numb the pain.
Yeah. from the grapevine to the vein, you will say more than you mean and all that. I mean, yeah, drink was, you know, both of us. I couldn't keep up with him, to be honest, when he was on it. But then I had a good go, though, you know. I'm not saying that I didn't.
Yeah.
And,
you weren't like Carlene Anderson going to bed early, like Carlene.
No, no way. You know, and it got out of hand sometimes, you know, because there was, you know, the manor, there was a couple of times when we were worse for wear, put it that way, and it got a bit edgy. I think I remember one time, you know, like I said, we both our fathers were boxers. Although I'm not sure we were about to indulge in the kind of what's the boxing thing anyway? It wasn't by the rules, but Queensbury rules. I think it got a bit heated, you know, and we were face to face and like going to fight and all that. And I remember Marco was there, little Marco, and he stood between us with a fire poker from the fireplace, saying, "Don't make me use this." And of course, it was ridiculous. And the next morning, it was all over and kisses and cuddles. I was also. There was part of me, I was immature. There was part of me that I was a little bit competitive as well, I think, when I think back to it. And in the end, I felt like I had to move away a little bit, because that whole network of pools and the fact they make you feel so comfortable and so loving, and it's such a thing, but it's like, can I grow in the shade of this great big tree? I was getting sort of tagged a little bit as a kind of Weller acolyte, which is fine, but I needed to go and find myself a bit more. And kind of moving to Spain, it wasn't for that reason. I moved to Spain for a million other reasons of my family and everything else. But we kind of fell out of that everyday thing that we used to know each other. But there's such a deep friendship that whenever we do see each other, it's just the same. But I needed to definitely, I mean, I'll take the blame for this. It was my insecurity and immaturity possibly when I was younger that made me too competitive sometimes. So in order to kind of find myself as an artist, I needed to kind of move away a little bit.
We'll return to the Blow Monkeys in a sec. I wanted to ask you one last question around that album, which is my understanding there's a stack of stuff that from those sessions that exists that hasn't been released. There was a lot of stuff you recorded that wasn't on that album. Would that be right?
On which album, sorry?
The Realms of Gold. Time.
Realms of Gold. Yeah, I believe there is, yeah. God knows where it is. I probably got it on a DAT or something somewhere.
Come on. Why are you not all organized with these archives? I was having a similar conversation the other day about Paul Weller's stuff. It's like, come on, why label it properly? Put it on the right place in the hard drive. Come on, man.
Yeah, when I'm gone, somebody else can do it.
some other poor son's going to have to go
through. Yeah, I'm working on a new one, you know. It's always like that. But yeah, I should have a look. There might be a few tasty bits in there. Who knows? I was so glad, you know, that doing this album where the 80s was over. So I remember thinking, right, I said to John, who was engineering, John Rivers, who actually engineered Ghost Town and recorded Ghost Town with the Specials. Fantastic engineer. I said, right, John, no EQ, no reverb, no effects, nothing. I kind of relented a little bit, but basically that's why it still sounds like it does, because it can't possibly date because we didn't put anything on it, you know. Mm. Yeah, I was just keen to play acoustic guitar and get moving again, you know.
A little while after that, so the move to Spain we talked about, there are other solo albums as well. But then the Blow Monkeys return. So this is towards the end of 2007. 2008, we get Devil's Tavern. We then get a stream of albums, you know, very productive. It must have been great to get back together with the band. As much as your solo thing, I know, is a huge thing and a big passion of yours, obviously.
Yeah.
Being back with the Blow Monkeys was an important moment for you.
Yeah, and look, I got to the point, and we all did, where it's kind of 18 years, right? And so the kids have left home, they're on their own, you know, they don't, it's not the same. So I fancy being in a band again. And of course, you know, what we're going to do? There's a band that I've been in and we've got this history. Are you up for it? I said to them all, they were, but I said, look, the thing is, we're going to make new albums. You know, that's what we're going to do. We're not going to do the nostalgia circuit. Of course, we do sometimes play those 80s festivals because they pay the rent for the rest of the tour. That wasn't what I wanted to do. So we have, you know, we're just about to release a new one again. We've made about 7 or something since we got back together. And I enjoy it more than ever because I know it's finite. I know the whole experience is finite. The things that used to really bug me about here, you know, sound checks, hotels, travel, that all the things musicians moan about, bring it on. I love it now. I love all that because you know what, Dan? I still haven't had to get a proper job.
I'm still waiting. You'd have only lasted 2 weeks in those anyway.
You're not cut out for this, mate. that's the headline. I love the whole thing about being a musician and doing what we do, especially in the world that we're in at the moment. It feels like ultimately a good thing to do. I was thinking that the other day when I was watching Paul and I was looking around the crowd and there was kind of like, at moments, real euphoria. But, well, this is a great thing to bring into the world at this very troubled time. This is a good thing to be doing.
Yeah, Paul talks about it almost being, still to him, it's a noble profession. And I think that's fair. You know, we missed live music so much during that period of lockdown when we couldn't experience it. When you came back out and that first gig, I mean, I was so emotional that first gig I was back in. So I'm like, God, this is such an important thing for that connection with the music, the community you're with, or just seeing a band live for the first time, all those things. I don't know. There's something about that live experience that's just so important.
Absolutely. We missed that. We know it's a human need. You know, we saw that during COVID. Set aside celebrity culture and all that crap, you know, that's not what we're talking about. But the best moments is when a musician and an audience just become one, and it's not about the band up on stage. They have a word for it in Spain called duende, which is like when the magic enters the room. At a certain point, people lose themselves. And that happens to the musicians as well that are on stage. It's not about me and you. Something happens. You keep chasing that, really, because that's an essential human experience.
There must also be that thing where, like you say, this is not about the nostalgia, although there's links to that, but it's about creating new material. And Paul talks about this with On Sunset and Fat Pop. I'm continually wanting to get better and create music that still connects and is great. And when you get the reaction like you got for Journey to You, your last album, Blow Monkeys, which is, I mean, I don't know how you measure like the quality of work over a previous album and all that kind of stuff, but that felt like, to me, like one of the best things you've ever created. It's an incredible piece of work. There must be something about that. You're just like, oh my God, yes, this is why I do this. We're getting better. We're improving. We're releasing great, great music.
Yeah, I mean, I think Paul would say this, you never know when that's going to come along. Half the thing, Dan, is stealth. Keep going. Just keep working because sometimes the clouds will open and you never know. And also you never know in the moment either. Sometimes it's only in retrospect that you see that something is quite good or it's not as good as you thought it was. So, you know, I couldn't tell, but just all I can say is that it's just through keeping working that sometimes you know, these things come round. It's not something that you can will into action, you know.
It also feels to me it's those connections that you've got, those collaborators that you're with. So we talked about the Monk's Road Social projects at the beginning of this, these wonderful collaborations with these such talented musicians that are part of that crew. But then you've got your Blow Monkeys and your bandmates there that you've been with for so many years as well. But you're all inspiring each other, aren't you?
Yeah, it's like a family thing. You know, Richard, who ran Monk's Road, approached me and said, yeah, what do you think? Do you think you can get this kind of collective thing together? It wasn't really kind of very solid idea, but I just started to make a few phone calls. And you know, songs, I had quite a lot of songs. I mean, I love, to be honest with you, the thrill of hearing other people sing my songs is that I'd still less of that. Well, yeah. And then other people started to get Matt Dayton came in and I didn't know Matt. I mean, we made an album together, actually. It's not out yet.
I heard that. This is not out yet. Yeah. When is this coming out?
hopefully next year, but Matt's got his own album to do, man, you know, and that's fair enough. He's doing his own thing. And then when that's done, it'll come out because that was really great fun. We did it 5 days up in Anglesey, just the two of us, acoustic guitars facing each other. And sharing one mic, actually. And it was great fun. So anyway, I met people like that. And of course, people that I knew. And Mick Talbot is just a gem. Mick is like, you know, gold dust. As a player, unbelievable. But as a person, even better, because he's just so funny. Just lovely to have about the place. I've known Mick a long, long time. Very special dude. All these Jacko coming in, brilliant. And of course, Crispin and Ernie, And Crispin plays with Blow Monkeys now, but Crispin and Ernie are just like the best, you know, at what they do. It was easy for me. I just had to sort of, you know, sit back and I produced it, but I didn't really have to because all these guys know what they're doing. So it was a lovely experience. We brought all sorts of people in, including people like Peter Capaldi, you know, who I'm just working on a new album with. And, you know, so I made some great new friends as well.
He lives just up the road from you there, doesn't he?
Well, he doesn't live here. He lives in London, but where I live here, I'm in the countryside, in the Finca, but where I live, I go for coffee in a local village. And that coffee shop or coffee place is like Stella Street. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
I don't know why, but you know, I've met some really good friends. So Alexi Sale, Peter Capaldi, Youth, the producer Youth, you know, who's got a studio in the corner for me, which has been dead handy, and another very lovely and generous guy. So slowly it kind of opened up.
And P.P. Arnold was another one who's been on the podcast. Pat was around the corner from you at one point, right?
I was around the court. Well, yeah, I went to some party and inevitably I started playing some songs and somebody said, oh, P.P. Arnold's over there in the corner. So I started playing some Curtis songs and we just started singing together. She says, do you know First Cut Is the Deepest? I went, no. She said, oh, one, two, three, four in the wind. And I went, oh, God. but I jammed it and then a light bulb went on in my head and I thought, do you want to fancy making an album? So we made an album together. It was like a folk soul album, if you know. If like. We did it down in the studio on the coast. She's proper A-list singer, Pat. She's really like Southern Baptist Church thing going, you know, it's proper. It was an honour.
And what a story. I mean, she was a terrific guest on the podcast as well. At the time of recording of this podcast, we are just days away from the release of Time Storm, Greatest Hits Volume 2 from the Blow Monkeys. When the podcast's out, the album would have just been released on the Friday just gone, right? Like I say, you are always pushing forward, but this is a chance to look back at from that regrouping, from when the band came back together, right?
Yeah, we're doing a new record at the moment, which will be out next May. And the label that we're doing it with, called Last Night from Glasgow, he said, listen, well, you should do a compilation of all the stuff you've done since, you know, we formed. So I said, okay, you know, let's do that. And it's a chance to sort of pause. And I mean, it's cheekily called Greatest Hits Volume 2, but you know, never mind. Yeah, I'm proud of it. I'm really proud of it. I actually think we've done all right since we reformed and we did what I wanted, which was move forward, keep making records.
The ridiculous thing to me as a Paul Weller fan is the fact that this time period that we're talking about is from when he released 22 Dreams 2008. That was when you were back with the Blow Monkeys, right? And to me, I mean, this must feel worse for you, but for me, this feels like this was yesterday. This is, you know what I mean? This is no time at all. But here we are, actually. That's a massive amount of time that's passed from that period. And so much has obviously happened, but it just feels like in a blink of an eye, that time has gone, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess time speeds up as you get older. And there is also the specter of, what could we say, the end. At some point, you know it's going to end. And therefore, there's a kind of... There's something else that enters the room and you start to think, well, so much I want to do. So many little ideas that I'd like to kind of explore. I want to carry on doing that. Maybe I've got to think about the work-life balance a bit more. Maybe I should get out a bit more. But there is something about, you know, that there's less time left than what's gone before. And that does kind of change the perspective about how you make records, how you work. Not just records, you know.
What can you tell us about the album that's coming out next year then?
But like a lot of stuff, it's a reaction to the last one. Journey to You was, in a sense, a kind of quintessential Blow Monkeys. It had big strings. It was quite orchestral. It's quite large, you know. So this is the opposite. That's all I can say, really. It's got, you know, it's bass, drums, guitar, one saxophone, voice, kind of raw and dry. And I'm excited about it, actually, because I'm just in the middle of mixing it, nearly finished it. So I think it's going to be all right.
Okay. And what about Monk's Road Social? Is there more to come? Because the Rise Up Singing album was, again, it just keeps building and building and building with these. There are lots more original songs on there as well. It's a terrific project. And we have the Weller connections, like you talk about. Leah Weller was on that album.
Leah, great singer. Lovely. I can't believe it. She's singing. I remember when she was born. Monk's Road is in abeyance at the moment, but I do believe that there will be another one. I think it's just, I've been so busy and I haven't spoken to Richard for a little while, but I think it's going to be an ongoing thing for sure. Yeah.
At some point, there's got to be a live show of that connecting. I don't know how you make that happen, but that's got to be a thing.
I would love that. You know, we can all the thing I say, plant your egos at the door, but no one's got egos in that lot. That's what's really good about it. It's not like that. There is a kind of, it is about the music and that's quite rare. So it'd be lovely to do a show. I mean, we nearly did one before, but then COVID came along. So I think we'll do another one.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. Hey, Robert, this has been honestly such a joy hearing your stories, your connections with Mr. Weller.
He's a very special dude. People don't always pick up. First of all, he's very funny. You're going to interview him eventually, aren't you?
You mentioned this podcast to him in Madrid, right?
Yeah, but in passing, he knows all about it. Don't worry about that. So an incredible, incredible songwriter, kind of unparalleled, really, in some ways, the journey that he's taken. So, you know, I'm more than happy to speak in his honour because, you know, it's been very influential on me, especially, like I said, when I was emotionally open as a teenager. Those things kind of really stay with you. I'm glad I spoke to you. I know it took a little while. And I was kind of, there were trepidations because I felt like I didn't want to betray a friendship, if you know what I mean. But if there's anything that I might have done, just cut it out.
Before we started recording this podcast, we were saying that we need some balance on this because everybody's been very, very praising of Mr. Weller.
Oh, no, listen, he can be a right difficult bugger. You know, he really can. He can be, yeah, especially when he's, you know, he can be. But I don't know anymore. I think we've all grown up. But like I said, that was partly me as well. Insecurity, competitiveness, you know, all that, it will more than partly me. So, yeah. No, I love the guy. Love him.
Two final questions for you. You're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What would you go with?
Oh, blimey. If it was The Style Council, it would be It All Came to Pieces in My Hands.
Oh, I love that song.
Which I love. And if it was Solo, it would be No Tears to Cry. As we're going back to kind of the place I love, which is where it really all began for me. I would say that Strange Town by The Jam is the perfect song. I mean, I think it's just lyrically in every way, it just hit me. I love singles, right? And The Jam were a great singles band.
Yes, of course. That was a standalone single, right?
Yeah, it was a standalone single. I think Butterfly Collector might have been on the B-side. It's around about the time of kind of all mod cons. But Strange Town would be, you know, if you want one today, tomorrow it would be different. It might be Burning Sky or Little Boy Soldiers, or even, I don't know, something from Wildwood, you know. I'd love Wildwood itself, the song. But today it's Strange Town.
Final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourself who've had these connections with Mr. Weller, to hear your story. But the reason I created this podcast, Robert, was because it was my one big regret from giving up my career as a radio presenter that I never got to interview Paul Weller. So I created a podcast to make that happen. If it happens, what should I ask him?
Oh, blimey. You could say, what do you think happens when we die?
That's a big question. He is a very spiritual character, I gather.
Well, you could shorten that and say, is God a mod? I mean, it's the same thing.
I know that you've spoken to him about mod and modernism, what that means to him. I guess it's linked to the spirituality thing as well, maybe. I don't know. But you've had that conversation in a way, right?
Oh, often, yeah. Because I'm fascinated. Because, you know, no offense, but his definition of mod is not a secret affair or one of those bands. It's like it encompasses everything. It's fascinating. I said he should do a book one day. His modernism, his philosophy of that is far wider than you would ever know. So, yeah, that's why I think a question like that would be perfect for him.
Robert, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Dan, thank you. Good luck with your Holy Grail.
Well, I told you it would be pretty special. What a blast. Dr. Robert Howard from the Blow Monkeys on the podcast. Incredible stuff. If you want to find out more, you can go to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. You'll find details about the Blow Monkeys, Time Storm, Greatest Hits Volume 2, info on the Style Council live in Japan, Paul Weller solo, Slam Slam, that 1994 debut solo album, Realms of Gold from Dr. Robert, and plenty more since then as well. Plus, of course, music from the Blow Monkeys and Monk's Road Social, all on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And whilst you're there, do head into my store. You can find official merchandise for the podcast. Plus, if you fancy it, get yourself a virtual coffee as well. Doing exactly that this week. Thank you, Grant. Hello to Colin and Jennifer Marsh, who say we love the podcast. Listening to the stories, the connections, the insider knowledge as a great dimension to being a Weller fan. Thanks, Dan. Well, thank you, Colin and Jennifer. Hello to Alex McLaughlin, who says the Carlene Anderson episode was fantastic. I listened to it in the car, got so absorbed that I missed my cutoff on the way to a meeting. Thank you, Alex. Hello to Neil, who says, loving your work, Dan. I'm a long-time Weller fan, and your contributions have brought back so many wonderful memories. I was probably a bit late to the party, and I'm slowly working my way through the episodes, up to number 88 now. Keep up the good work. That's a great thing, Neil. You can join at any time. Hello to Vince Bicarino, who says, really enjoyed the Carleen Anderson pod. Keep up the good work, Dan. Hello to Marcin Morrow. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. Hello, Brian G. Hello, Ewan, who says, cheers, Dan. The interview with Carleen was brilliant. Long hopes for. Great job. Thanks a lot. Hello to Mike Steer. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hello to Sarah Kane. Hi, Sarah. If you want to get involved on the next episode, you can dive into my store, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Now, if you do anything after listening to this podcast, make sure you click share on your social media channels. Spread the word. Dr. Robert on the podcast. Tell your friends. Make sure they listen. You can get in touch on Twitter or X or whatever it's called this week. It's at Weller Fan Pod, or on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. And coming up this coming Friday, 3rd of November, a very special celebration, the 45th anniversary of All Mod Cons from The Jam. A little treat for you with an extra episode, okay? So make sure you check out the podcast this coming Friday, 3rd of November, as we celebrate 45 years of All Mod Cons with All Mod Cons. The original tribute to The Jam. Follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, and more. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.